From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New leadership in Washington and Concord means new approaches toward economic policy, from regulation to taxation to trade. And that's a big topic of conversation among econ geeks and business types alike. Also, New Hampshire's employment gurus have peered into the future at the top Granite State occupations and skills required for the next decade. And a national business publication has ranked New Hampshire pretty poorly for the way the state funds its public employee pension system. It's our monthly economic roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you on these topics and more. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, welcome back. Good to see you.
It's good seeing you, Laura.
Also with us, Steve Norton, executive director of the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies. Steve, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Nice to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Russ Thibault, president of Applied Economic Research, an economic and real estate consulting firm in Laconia. And Russ, thank you for your time.
Good to be here. Thanks, Laura.
Well, and Russ, not to steal too much from our sister program, Marketplace, but let's do the numbers. And you've got some big ones that you've been looking at.
Yeah, looking at the national numbers, we kind of have an economy that's continuing to grow moderately. GDP was up 2.9% in the third quarter.
This is, again, U.S.
These are U.S., right, which is really the value of all goods and services in the country. It's the broadest measure of economic activity. That's a two-year high. That was a good number, 2.9%. We added 161,000 jobs in October, which was just enough to absorb the increase in the labor force, so the unemployment rate stayed the same. 161,000 jobs nationally. That's a pretty good number. We've been up over 200,000 in recent months. Inflation, 1.5%. That's still low, but
1.5%. Wow.
Yeah, it's still low, but it's kind of showing some upward momentum, which the Fed may be paying attention to in terms of interest rate. Unemployment rate nationally, 4.9%. But if you include underemployed and people that are working part time but would like to be full time, it's twice that. Overall, nothing really alarming on the national front. An economy that is continuing to expand at a moderate, sustainable pace is the way I would characterize it.
Big economic numbers here in New Hampshire, Steve Norton.
Yeah, I'd say New Hampshire's actually doing better than the nation right now, which is sort of the first time in a long time. When you look at some of the work that the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis has done around GDP growth, New Hampshire was the fifth fastest growing state in the country back in the first quarter of 2016. We haven't seen the new analyses at the state level.
Fifth fastest. That's not bad.
No, not bad at all. Washington, Oregon, Colorado, Arkansas grew faster than we did. But I thought that was remarkably good news, especially when, you know, you're continuing to see our unemployment rate drop, which means we're creating more jobs than, you know, our labor force is growing, so which is both a good thing and a bad thing. So New Hampshire economy, first part of the recovery from the Great Recession, kind of weak, maybe now seeing a little accelerated growth.
Well, and let's pick up, Jeff, if we could, on that unemployment number that Steve mentioned. Just this week, the State Department of Employment Security announced a 2.8% unemployment rate for the Granite State. What's involved in that, Jeff? Because it sounds really good.
Yeah, it is actually, compared to all the other states in the country, it's good. It's the lowest in the country, which is really just amazing. I mean, it's back in New Hampshire, the unemployment rate is back where it's has been historically in New Hampshire, very low. And it's one of the things about it that's interesting is that the rate went down, but there were fewer people working. And it's,
is that because we're an older state?
Yeah, I'm not quite clear on that. Maybe Russ could have an idea about this, but it's something that it should really be kind of a red flag. Like, what's going on here? I mean, as Steve said, we have a lot more jobs. We have more jobs than we have people to fill.
Yeah,
them.
We've talked a lot about that on this program. But go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, I think it might be just seasonal adjustment. You know, we're picking up. You have the summertime, and New Hampshire has very volatile employment from month to month, particularly the summertime when tourism season is really kicked in. So that could be just seasonal adjustment. The fact of the matter is we're adding about 13,000 jobs a year right now, which is back to the kind of fast growth we've had in the past. And of course, I've been on the show and talking about New Hampshire's lagging. We're not a fast growing state anymore. But these job numbers are starting to make me scratch my head and say, you know, are we going to really actually go back to being a fast growing state again?
Well, it sounds like it from the numbers Steve gave us.
It's kind
earlier.
Of the tip of the iceberg. It's too recent, not durable enough to say it's there for forever. But the numbers have been good for maybe the last 6 months have been higher than they've been in terms of job growth per se. So I think the blip on the labor force might – I wouldn't get too worried about it.
Well, I'm not losing sleep over it right now.
No.
Now that you explained it.
There's other things to worry about, Jeff.
No, but the other thing you have to think about is that, you know, a lot of – what are the jobs that are available? You know, where are those jobs? What do they pay? And, you know, if you talk about, you know, an increase in the labor force, if we had some unbelievable jobs and we had housing that's available and everything, then I'd say, you know, maybe we are ready for a big growth spurt, but we don't have those things necessarily.
Well, let's talk about that. But Steve, first, you know, we've talked about this in past economic roundups, but just a reminder, you see that 2.8% unemployment, you think, hooray, that's great. But you and others have talked about part of that is problematic because employers can't find the people that they need.
That's right. And I think that is the single largest constraint right now for the economy. Will we be able to grow that labor force? We cannot grow an economy without having people to work in it. And either wages are going to increase, which are going to draw people in, or some other things are going to change that make New Hampshire more attractive relative to other places, or we can't grow.
Russ, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, we're starting to see some wage growth, but it's really lagged this improvement in employment. And
why is that? It seems like supply and demand. You need more people, let's pay them more, and then they'll come in.
It's starting to happen. It's happening in manufacturing. We're looking at a 5% year-over-year increase in average hourly wage in manufacturing. It hasn't happened across the board. And I think the reason why is this whole issue of underemployment. There are a lot of people that had good jobs maybe in 2007. They had to settle for a less attractive job. And now as the economy is getting strong, they're able to move back up. And so there's a lot of slack in the labor force despite the very low unemployment rate. And it's in the form of underemployment.
The exchange number for you to join us, it's our monthly economic roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So let's dig into that 10-year forecast that the Department of Employment Security, again, put out just recently. A decade ahead for the jobs that will be here in New Hampshire and the skills required for those jobs. Ross, I think I'll turn to you first, but want to hear from everybody. What are the growth areas over the next decade that the department is projecting? What kind of occupations are expected to grow the most?
It's really healthcare is very, very prominent. They're projecting a total of 47,000 new jobs, more or less, over the decade. And I think 20-25% of those jobs are in one industry, health and health related. So,
now say that again, because that's big.
Nearly 20-25, a quarter to a fifth of those jobs are in just one sector of the economy, which is healthcare.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, we talk a lot about technology, but of the 47,000 jobs that the state is projecting, the state will grow by 47,000 growth in jobs, only about 2,500 of them are in computer and mathematical occupations. And the number of healthcare jobs almost 10 times higher. So there's very, very pronounced differences from sector to sector of the economy. The strongest by far is healthcare and related. And then as you move down through the sectors of the economy, legal, not so much, architectural engineering, not so much job growth. But it's really, you know, if you had somebody who said, look, I really want to be sure I'm going to get a job when I finish this education stuff, I would push them towards healthcare right now.
Unless they're like me and they don't like the sight of blood.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be problematic.
You know, anecdotally, I have two friends. One has a daughter with a master's degree in kind of counseling type stuff, and she's unemployed and has been for 6 months. I have another friend who has a daughter that went into nursing at an entry level kind of position, a licensed nurse assistant, and she had three job offers the day she got her license. So I think that both in terms of the math of this, the state's projections, and anecdotally, I think the big thing is healthcare.
Well, I'd love to hear from you guys too on this. I think it's amazing what Russ is telling us from these numbers, just huge amounts of healthcare jobs.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it reflects our population and where we're headed over the next 10 years. We're just getting older. And when you get older, you know, there's more needs for facilities, need for healthcare, and just the whole thing. And, you know, that is really it's tied to that in a lot of ways because, you don't hear the story. You don't hear this great demand for teachers down the road as much as you had maybe had in the past in these kinds of projections.
Although there was a note in those 10-year projections, a little bit of an increase for elementary school teachers. I was surprised by that, given the aging population. Maybe that's people leaving the field. I'm not sure.
I think that in a lot of ways, we still have teachers who are aging out. They just are retiring, and that there is a replacement. There is a need for teachers, but it's not at the level of healthcare or technicians and assistants and practitioners.
Steve, love to get your thoughts on this too.
We look back 20 years and we sort of got away from vocational manufacturing because everyone said manufacturing was dead. And as a result, now we were in this place where we had too few folks that could work in the manufacturing. Now we're steering the boat in a different direction. And we, again, I think we've said this before, just need to be cautious that we don't oversteer the boat again away from these other types of jobs that are important. You need HR people, you need healthcare people, you need programmers and everything else. If we put all of our eggs in one basket, we're going to have workforce training problems in a different direction.
I mean, we've done this before historically in the United States. Back in the years after Sputnik went up. Now I'm showing my age. But, then all of a sudden we need engineers. We need engineers. So everybody was supposed to go to engineering school. And then we had too many engineers. And then, everybody wanted to go to business school. That's the best place to go to business school. And now we have people with business degrees that necessarily aren't just as marketable as they may have been. And actually, you could see it even in law degrees are not as – people aren't as employable as they have been.
I mean, it's true also now that – The jobs available are largely driven by healthcare and sales. We have
sales was the other big category, right?
So 6,000, 7,000 online jobs for healthcare and sales, and 1,400, 1,500 for these types of programming jobs that require those skills that are generally associated with STEM.
So a lot less.
A lot less, yeah.
Russ,
the other thing, and I don't mean to overplay this. But the majority of the jobs, 54% of the jobs, over half of the jobs require only a high school degree or less. They're in sales, okay? They're in restaurants, accommodations. Half of the job growth is in sectors of the economy or in occupations that only require a high school degree or less.
So how do we interpret that?
Well, I think that what it says is that we have an economy that doesn't have a lot of high-paying jobs, as we all know. That's the main thing, and that's likely to continue going forward. So I wouldn't take this as saying, don't go to college because there's more jobs. No, go to college. But still, we should be aware in terms of policy that a lot of the job growth we have is in sales, is in restaurants, is in lodging and accommodations, those sectors of the economy, and they don't require more than a high school degree. Then there's all the associate degree jobs, things like plumbing, some of the nursing assistant jobs. So
those are good paying jobs.
Right. I think we sort of bifurcate things and say, get a college degree or you're not going to have employment opportunities. That's overstating the situation.
Steve?
At the 30,000-foot level, this tells me just that we don't have an economy that people think are going to grow in industries that are high-paying and also part of the general broader economic development activities out there. And so we got to have people who are doing healthcare. We got to have trained people to do that. But what are we going to do, on the other hand, to create jobs that would then be open in a place like New Hampshire for these high-tech or STEM-related positions?
Yeah, that has been the trend in New Hampshire for years. It's just we've been progressing more and more and more to this more and more relying on the service economy as opposed to the manufacturing, and we've seen the manufacturing sector shrink. For decades, and it's still pretty strong, but it's nowhere near at the size or strength that it had been.
The exchange number again is 1-800-892-6477. Join us. It's our monthly look at top economic headlines around New Hampshire. If you're an employer, what jobs are you having a hard time filling? If you're looking for work, what skills do you think you need to get that job that you want? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And, gentlemen, let's go to the phones. David's joining us from Alton. Hi, David. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for putting me on the air.
Sure.
So I'm the STEM director with the New Hampshire Department of Education.
Oh, wow.
And part of my job is I'm sort of tasked with executing some of the recommendations of the governor's STEM task force. So if you look at those, if you look at those four sectors that were identified in that report, and they're some of the ones that you were just talking about. So you have finance and insurance, the kind of the business aspect. You have healthcare, you have IT, and you have advanced manufacturing.
And sales was another big one. Yeah.
And sales, okay. And sales was another big one. So I look at you can in select career and technical centers, you can study those sorts of things. But what is kind of the core of that thing that we should be bringing back to all the schools? Because we know that for various factors, certain students aren't going to go to the CTE centers. There are certain barriers to go to those centers. So I've been really focusing in the past few months on expanding computer science education, because if you look at all of those, computing and I mean computer science in a broad sense, so including data analysis, including systems. If you go through them one at a time, so, IT is obvious. Healthcare, a large percentage, I think it's 30 or 40% of those jobs are technologists and technicians. If you look at advanced manufacturing, well, what makes it advanced? It's the automation, it's the computers, it's the programming. I think I missed one, but you can sort of see what I'm getting at. So I was
sure. So those technical skills are used broadly, you're saying, David, across all sectors, really?
Right. So I'm saying specifically those higher order computing skills are used broadly in these various sectors, and it's something that can be brought back to the high schools because you don't need necessarily any specialized equipment because the schools have the computers. It's a matter of how they're using them. So really what is needed is the training in the schools and the informing schools about like how great this need is.
Okay.
And what is computer science and how can they bring it into their schools.
And computer science doesn't just mean getting a degree programming. It means all sorts of things, especially in healthcare, I would imagine, right? I mean, there's a lot of technology involved. Go ahead, Russ.
I was just going to say, I think he makes a good point. We're dealing with the difference between being just a computer programmer and being having computer literacy. And there's no question that computer literacy is just a part of life. Young people are very good at it, as it turns out, much better than people my age. So I think that as a supplemental skill, kind of like maybe typing was decades ago, maybe you're not going to be a professional typist your whole life, but it's a good idea to have it.
And I'm glad I studied typing.
Yeah, the one-finger thing doesn't work.
Although,
I took it in high school.
My kids do the one-finger peck, peck, peck pretty
quickly. Yeah, they're quick at it. So I think the distinction is computer literacy, yes. But if you look at these occupational, if you're going to be a computer programmer, we may have oversold that.
All right. Well, David, thank you so much for calling in. Good to hear from you. Let's go to Roxbury next. Jim is on the air. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi, Laura. This is Jim Ramonier.
Oh,
I'm
hi, Jim.
With a question. How you doing? So I'm calling with a question rather related to the latest numbers on employment. Specifically, are those numbers, those are state numbers. So do you notice any regional differences either in the current numbers or in the projected numbers?
You're talking about the unemployment numbers, Jim?
Employment, unemployment, yes.
Okay, sure. Great. Good question. Thank you so much. Steve?
Yeah, we obviously do see lots of variation. Labor markets are much tighter in the southern and eastern part of the state than they are in the more rural parts of the state. And the farther north you go, the higher the unemployment rate is. But strangely enough, it doesn't get up above the national average anywhere in New Hampshire except the very far reaches of the north. And that's because the workforce is still declining in those parts of the state.
Yeah. Jeff, what are you seeing? You're covering businesses and trends around the state.
Yeah. Well, actually, what we've seen is certainly when we're talking about the north country of New Hampshire, Coas, parts of Grafton, parts of Carroll County, it's really just not the same economy that we have in the southern part of the state. We're in the southern part of the state. We have a different view of the world than we do once you get north of the notches. And it's really it's something that's been going on. We've seen this for years. It's ever since the mills started closing. And it's just been this drip, drip, drip of loss of jobs up there and loss of people. And that's something. And also, it's true in other rural areas as well. But there are certain signs of hope, like in places like Claremont, which they really are trying to revive their economy, bringing jobs in.
Well, Jim, it's a great point. Thank you for the call. And I've got an email here, gentlemen, that gets to something I want to talk about after a short break. That is the possibilities of Trumponomics and Sununuonomics for the Granite State. More monthly economic roundup in just a minute. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our monthly economic news roundup. And among the headlines we're looking at, a new forecast of the jobs and the skills needed for the next 10 years here in the Granite State. Also, in a minute, how the new governor may approach economic policy here in New Hampshire. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And gentlemen, before we turn to new leadership again in D.C. and Concord, what that might mean economically, let's finish up, Russ Thiebaud, if we could please, on this projection for the jobs and skills of the future here in New Hampshire. Jim asked a question. How does this look regionally? And I'd love your thoughts there, too.
Yeah. Steve's right that the unemployment rate, even in the North Country, is not exceptionally high. It's low everywhere. But the distinction comes in terms of job growth. OK, where are we going to be adding jobs given this projection by State Employment Security? If you go to the North Country, the next 10 years, we will add about 2,200 jobs. That's in contrast to southern New Hampshire, Rockingham County, and the Manchester region, where we'll be adding 35,000 jobs. So the job growth in southern New Hampshire is 10 times that of northern New Hampshire going forward.
10 times that?
10 times.
That's
only
giant.
2,200 jobs in the entire northern portion of the state, and 35,000 jobs in the Manchester region and the Seacoast region. So essentially all of our job growth. Now, the unemployment rate is pretty uniform across the state, but job growth is very much skewed to southern and Seacoast.
Getting to those demographic factors that Steve mentions. Again, the low unemployment in the North Country doesn't mean things are booming. It just there's not a lot of people.
Yeah, if people leave the North Country, the unemployment rate goes down, even if there's no job growth. So it's
And this is not unusual in rural areas across the country. So there are bright spots in the North Country. The communities are starting to reestablish themselves around amenities and the like. It's just the jobs are continuing to go elsewhere.
And to give you a segue into our next segment, that's really one of the main reasons why there was such an outpouring of support for Donald Trump, because of his message to people in those rural communities where they have felt this this just loss of jobs and the loss of economic futures.
Especially those robust manufacturing jobs that paid so well. Here's a Facebook comment from Robin who says, I'm curious about the wages that are expected in these healthcare jobs. We talked earlier about the giant growth in this sector. Robin says, an LNA makes $9 to $10 an hour. These are not sustainable wages. Robin, thank you for the comment. Russ?
The average wage in healthcare practitioners and technical occupations average. Now, this includes physicians then, as $40. And actually,
$40 an hour?
$40 an hour overall in healthcare, the average, because it includes brain surgeons as well as janitors in hospitals. So there's a big, wide range.
That's not
range
a very
there.
Good number.
It is a good number.
No,
Laura.
because it doesn't give us the specificity that the emailer
so
asks.
So what happens then if you go to the lower end of the spectrum, LNAs? My friends mentioned got a job in an LNA. It's $16 an hour on weekends, $12 an hour during the week, $14 an hour if it's the night shift. So it's $12 to $16 an hour. Got the job.
For a highly skilled job, I mean, you can make that kind of money working at a grocery store.
Yeah. Well, that's where it is now. Yeah.
Well, and that's part of the problem with raises. Wages are rising in the healthcare field somewhat, but not as fast as it can be. But the other thing is you have to remember in that category is also people of technicians. And those are people with skills that are definitely compensated for, whether they're
phlebotomists.
X-ray machines, whatever,
There's a lot of technology in it.
Let's take another call, guys. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We'd love your thoughts, questions, comments about some of these economic headlines we're covering, including a forecast for jobs and skills for the next decade. And in just a minute, we'll turn again to new political leadership and how that might affect economic policy. But let's go to James in Whitefield. Hi, James. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
Go ahead, James.
Hello?
Yep. Go ahead.
I just had the question where they talk about the lack of growth in the North Country. And I know that in the neighboring states with Maine and Vermont, there's a lot of work coming out of universities with agriculture, but you don't see that as much in the state of New Hampshire. And I'm just wondering if that has a lot to do with more of a lot of the schools being in the southern area and more towards technology and not towards possible growth in agriculture that could affect the north of the state.
So Vermont using its, rural location as a benefit, James, and expanding its agriculture study programs and seeing some good come out of that. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. What do you think? Do you want to talk about that, Jeff?
Well, I have my own suspicion, and that is that, New Hampshire has historically always been less of an agricultural-based economy. And always,
we're the granite state.
Yes,
so.
Yeah, things don't grow on granite very well. And so we've never really stressed the agriculture in this state as much as certainly as Vermont and Maine, to a very, you know, with potatoes, blueberries, and all that other stuff you know about. You know, New Hampshire has always, its economy has always been based on the rivers, the mills. You go to all towns all over the state, you'll see the old mills that were built there, the mill buildings, all along the rivers, the dams. And that's really been the history of New Hampshire's economy.
Well, James, thank you for the call. And let's take another one, gentlemen. This is Michael in Farmington. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for calling in.
Great. I want to thank you very much for taking me on here. I have a lot to share with you about the subjects that you're talking about. I lived them. I lived them in 1979 out of high school at 18 years old, and I had an opportunity to go to school for welding and fabrication. A company sent me to school, and they paid for my qualifications, and I was able to accumulate 36 nuclear qualifications in TIG, MIG, and STIC. And I have to say that you're on the right track as far as people getting a good degree in welding, fabrication, and other areas. Because once you get a stamp, a nuclear stamp at 36 and qualify, you'll work and weld any place because people want you. And I only have a 12th grade degree, and I did very well.
So grateful for the fact, Michael, that the company gave you that certification. They took the time and money to train you that way.
Well, you know, what happened was a guy that worked at the company was the chauffeur to the president, and he said, hey, I'm looking for work, as he says. If you come and work for me, I'll send you to school so you can weld. In fact, I said, I never weld in my life.
Oh, that's great.
So he said, if you come and physically work, I'll train you and I'll send you to school. And he sent me to school, and you're exactly right. Our people, the American people, need training in those areas. People need to step out and help our people.
You know, Michael, I'm so glad you called. This is something we've talked about in other programs on the Exchange. And, Steve, I'll turn to you first. Has there been a shift in terms of who takes this training on? I have heard that in the past, like Michael's experience, companies were willing to say, look, you're a young guy, you got a good attitude and good energy, I'm going to take a chance, I'm going to train you, and here he is, you know, having a successful career. Now it seems like the burden is more on the person to A, figure it out, and B, pay for it.
I would say that was probably true 5 years ago, but maybe a little bit more. But now there's a lot of pressure on businesses to find these individuals who can do the work.
And so they are more willing to do what this person did for
Michael.
They
are, and they're building out really pipelines, whether it's Hypotherm building its own community technical college within its walls, or Albany International working with Great Bay Community College, or New Hampshire Ball Bearing working with local community schools in Laconia and the community college system to produce, you know, economic opportunity. So there are, you know, these types of public-private collaborations are popping up all over the state. The New Hampshire Business and Education Coalition is really focused on helping support the growth of this. And the state has adopted, you know, a 65-25 initiative, which is by 2025, 65% of folks will have, you know, an accredited stamp of approval. I think the gentleman said nuclear so that they have some skills that are needed within, you know, the demands of the economy as we understand it.
So the return to the apprenticeship.
Yeah, it is sort of a return to the apprenticeship, but a little more sophisticated in that the there's a recognition that you need a pipeline of workers and businesses and schools and local communities are really working hard to build them.
So that narrative I gave is a little outdated. That's changing now. Okay,
well,
Jeff.
But it is also true that, you know, 30 years ago or so, businesses did pay for training, and they'd take people in and train them. And then there were, you know, in the 80s and 90s, they just said, we didn't want to pay for this. We cut that off on that. You know, we just took that off the ledger. We're not paying for training. And we have now come to, you know, full circle where they've realized, well, maybe we should have been doing this before because we need to have the employees to work.
Well, and look how well it's worked out for our caller, Michael. So,
absolutely.
Michael, thank you for calling in. And another Michael is calling in, this one in Peterborough. Hi, Michael. You're on the air. Welcome. Go ahead.
How are you?
Fine. Go ahead, sir.
So I listened to a comment just before. One of your guests was talking about the healthcare industry and the potential for high-wage jobs in healthcare.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to remind him that, you know, way wages in healthcare are a huge part of the cost of healthcare. And, you know, we're moving more towards a consumer-driven healthcare system. And I would remind, like, it's the cost in, say, plastic surgery or LASIK surgery. The costs have gone down dramatically as they become more efficient. And I think that if we do get to a consumer-driven healthcare model, you may find that those jobs may start to evaporate a little bit.
You know, that's a really interesting point. Yeah, go ahead.
We could be far more efficient in healthcare, and trust me, I know I work in healthcare and have for a very long time. And we could be far more efficient, especially if patients were paying the bills more directly.
Interesting. So we talked about, you know, why aren't wages in healthcare going up, Russ, given the huge demand in the future and now. But Michael's raising a good point. You know, us, the patients, we don't want to pay a lot more.
I know. And the entire financing of healthcare, and I know this is Steve's arena much more so than mine, but the cost of healthcare, and we are shifting towards consumers paying a larger portion, not a blank check anymore out of your healthcare insurance. So we've seen layoffs. We've seen sizable layoffs at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, kind of an anchor healthcare facility for the state. I know in my area, Lakes Region General Hospital has had some staff reductions. So he makes a good point. These are the projections. The projections kind of build on national expectations, but things can change quickly in sectors like healthcare where money moves fast.
You want to jump in, Jeff?
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, we've have seen layoffs and there's been a lot of consolidation in the healthcare industry in New Hampshire and elsewhere, and you know we've the effects would be theoretically lower employment because they could synergize or whatever the word is they use to you know cut costs. So, you know, that is what trend right now, but who knows? As I said, as our state gets older, there'll be more need for these services. And that's the other thing we have to think about.
And I'd just say there's potential for great change nationally, federally, in with new leadership. President-elect Trump has indicated that he'd like to repeal the Affordable Care Act. There are plans out there to, in some way, privatize Medicare. Those trends are going to materially impact everything in New Hampshire with respect to health care. And then I would just remind the gentleman who called in that while we might see a decrease in the costs, the demand for health care is just going up every time we age, which is every year.
Every so month when every, you guys come on for the monthly economic roundup, right, there's more demand for
don't blame us.
Right. You know, just the quick number to reinforce what Steve said, I know he knows this, that all of the state's net population growth over the next several decades is going to be over age 65. So the demand is very, very strong. The question is, how are we going to pay for it?
Well,
how are we going to provide it?
And let's turn then to, because we're sort of going there anyway, to new leadership. Again, President-elect Trump, not a lot of specifics during the campaign, but I think to you first, Russ, very quickly, what do we know about Trumponomics, the general themes?
Not enough, in a nutshell. The morning after the election, I went online, and Economist magazine, the quote was, "The implications are enormous." Now, then 5 minutes later, a quote from Mark Zandi of Moody's, who's
often quoted,
often
right? Worked for John McCain.
Kind of the go-to guy saying, it's not cataclysmic for the economy. So, I mean, here's two well-regarded vehicles saying it's tremendous or it's not such a big deal. So the bottom line is there's a lot of uncertainty, and that has been reflected in particularly in terms of interest rates, which have risen sharply since a week ago.
Well, I took a look around, too, at a couple headlines, and economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal raised their economic forecasts, saying they were excited about lower taxes and increased infrastructure, but also very worried about restrictions on trade and immigration, with some of them saying, you know, that could be very difficult for the economy. Go ahead, Steve.
And I think that's the only thing you really know right now is that there is a strong position that's protectionist in a way that we have not been or had a leader who was protectionist in the way President-elect Trump is. Immigration, we know that there's great concerns. We also know that the immigration provides an important lubricant to the labor market, and without that, we might have some. So I think that's why they're concerned about it.
Because immigrants tend to be younger, too,
younger
Steve, right?
and willing to take lower paying jobs that then can move into other. So they really do provide a lubricant for the the labor market. Infrastructure expenditures, $1 trillion was the number that was bandied about. That's very difficult to see how you could come up with the resources for that necessarily. But, you know, I think that's what the markets have responded to.
I just wanted to say that another thing about immigrants, that they're also very entrepreneurial and they start businesses. And that's something else that the economy would be losing if there were restrictions. And one of the things I just wanted to say was that, you know, when in terms of trade specifically, New Hampshire has a, you know, many companies in New Hampshire are involved in international trade, especially with countries like, as we talked about, with in Canada, over in Europe, China as well. And if there's some kind of limitations, if there's some kind of tariff thing, that could have a major effect specifically on New Hampshire companies as well as everybody other countries and companies in the country.
Well, just one other major item. We've talked about trade, talked about lower taxes, regulation.
Less regulation. That's
less
right.
Regulation.
Business economists said they were excited about that as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah. So that's another big aspect of it.
Well, I want to turn to the economic policies of our governor-elect in just a minute. But let's take another call first. And Mike is waiting in Bedford. So go ahead, Mike. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks, Laura.
Sure.
I was involved in a great infrastructure mansion in New Hampshire in the 70s and 80s. So we watched the employment possibilities and the expansion of business, industry, and real estate. What does the panel think of even the generalized proposed infrastructure program of President-elect Trump, particularly in the North Country, which is pretty anemic for employment right now?
Okay, Mike, thank you very much. So we were just touching on that. So go ahead, guys. You want to give us a little bit more on the possibilities for infrastructure improvements for us?
Go ahead, Jeff.
I was just going to say that, you know, that's there's a great demand for that in New Hampshire, around the country. And this was, I have to say, was a discussion we had back in 09 and 10 when President Obama was trying to do that.
Right.
And there was a little recalcitrance on the part of the Republican Party to go along with as much money as he wanted to spend. And it remains to be seen whether they're going to still go along with it when it's President Trump suggesting this kind of, you know, huge bill. But New Hampshire specifically in terms of roads and bridges, we need to be spending money. The state itself is not necessarily spending the money. We're spending a lot of money on widening I-93, which has a lot of development aspects to it. But otherwise, when you get north of it, there's a lot of need, and especially in the North Country, where the cities and towns up there just don't have the resources that they once had to do road improvements to actually, you know, to build these things. And it would be a great stimulus economically, specifically for places where there's underemployment.
Steve?
I guess I wonder what we mean by infrastructure. Roads and bridges are just one portion.
Yeah.
The expansion of I-93, the water distribution systems in our communities.
Water treatment plants, I heard, need a huge upgrade across the state.
You know, schools, we're going through a profound change in the state with respect to the number of kids. Schools are consolidating. They want to build new. So there's lots of different infrastructure possibilities, and I don't think we really know what those things look like.
You know, if you go back to the Depression, you go back to President Roosevelt, you know, there were dams, there were post office, government build. I mean, they built everything.
Right.
And $1 trillion, I don't know what $1 trillion buys you today.
Right.
I mean, maybe Russ knows.
It's too many zeros. I was going to say, one of the things you have to look at about Trump's infrastructure program is he's talking about it being privately funded, which I think is – I don't see how you can do – $1 trillion of private funding for infrastructure. I mean, things like toll roads, but only 3% of our, you know, highways are toll. I don't know where that comes in.
Okay, so coming up, we will turn from Trumponomics to Sununuonomics. Say that 10 times fast and stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our monthly economic news roundup. We've been looking at a number of key economic headlines of the past few weeks. Right now, we're talking about how new leadership in Washington and in Concord may affect economic policy. Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on Facebook at NHPR. Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So Jeff Feingold, Steve Norton, Russ Thiebaud, let's turn now to the incoming governor, Chris Sununu. And here's a Facebook comment from Bill, who says, passenger rail is dead for the next 2 years due to Sununu's victory. How will the lack of rail affect New Hampshire's economic development? Steve, you've looked at this.
This is a question of infrastructure. I think the Colin Van Ostrand, who was running against Governor Alex Sununu, really was pushing hard for rail as a means of bringing people to New Hampshire. I think the evidence on that was mixed about what it would or would not do in the short term. There were some longer term economic projections suggesting that it was of economic value. I think what Governor Alex Sununu has said is there are some shorter term requirements, infrastructure requirements like roads and bridges and finishing some of that work. I don't know whether he is opposed to rail in its entirety or whether he thinks there are other needs that need to be accomplished first. But certainly his economic plan does not include rail and does include other infrastructure investments.
And then there was, as we've talked about a few times on this show, is the there's been a clamor down the southern part of the state, specifically in Nashua and Manchester, and to some extent Concord, to bring that rail from Boston up here. And those plans are not going to happen unless somehow the state of Massachusetts decides they want to do it for us.
Or maybe Trump decides that that's part of the infrastructure program.
That's part of the infrastructure program. I have a feeling it's not, because I do know that that was President Obama's big thing, was high-speed rail that candidate Trump was dismissive of.
Well, stepping back, Jeff, what are you hearing from businesses about their hopes for the Sununu administration?
Well, I think preliminarily they're pretty optimistic about this, especially with the full Republican legislature, because there's some unfinished business that they've had in terms of tax cuts that they'd like, R&D tax credit particularly, capital equipment deductions that were kind of compromised out last year.
Compromised because we had a Democratic
governor. Yeah, they tried to raise the limit on capital deductions to equal the federal requirement, the federal limit, and we're still far short of that. So they'll do that. I do know I haven't talked specifically about it, and I still have not met too many business people specifically who are, you know, gung-ho about this. I don't think they really think about it, but the idea of right to work will likely go through. I can't imagine it won't. Senator D'Alessandro, who's been an outspoken opponent of this, has basically said, you know, we're going to be a right-to-work state. Various other things, and I think that really it's been some unfinished business that they've been trying to do for many – you know, during many sessions now, regulations and other thing.
This is the first time Republicans have had all the top jobs in the state for a long time.
For a very long time. It used to be forever.
At least.
You know, there was a time in this state when that was just a normal thing. But now,
so lower business taxes, possibly right to work. We asked Governor Alex Sununu in our debate about right to work. He said possibly, kind of holding out there. Minimum wage. Governor Alex Sununu said he'd follow the federal minimum wage, wouldn't push to raise New Hampshire's minimum
wage. I just want to say
one
thing about the minimum wage, because I know we have talked about this before, but Maine has approved an increase in its minimum wage.
That's
next
right.
Door to $12 an hour. So we will be by far the lowest wage state in terms of minimum wage in New England, and with the federal rate, we'll be the lowest in the country. Where everybody also keeps the federal rate, and that could have an effect on the border states, the border towns, you know, in terms of employment in those retail industries and hospitality as well.
Yeah, I was going to say that here we are with a very tight labor force situation, and this kind of wage disparity just encourages an out-migration of labor, either just move to Massachusetts or stay in New Hampshire but work in Massachusetts.
Especially if you're on the border.
Yeah, exactly, in those southern areas where we're going to see most of the job growth.
Yes.
So there's a little bit of a friction, economic friction.
Although businesses can raise wages whenever they want, even if
the state
minimum wage is $7.25,
that's
they
right.
can raise it to 8. I know a certain teenager who works at McDonald's who doesn't make minimum wage.
Right, so. And I think it's happening, and that's good.
That's
the other side of the coin. Well, that's the other side of the argument, which is don't worry about the minimum wage. Let the market forces drive wages up.
It's going to happen for the most part, though, around – I think it's going to be happening around the borders, not necessarily in the parts of the state where, you know, maybe up in the North Country or whatever, where this is not going to be – it's not as easy to get to a place where they're going to be paying $12 an hour.
As Governor Alex Sununu goes forward, the major vehicle through which he is going to try and move forward his economic development plans or is through the state budget. He's got to put his budget together by February 14th or 15th. R&D tax credits, capital deductions, changes to the BPT and the corporate tax structure, all of those require some expense and along with balancing that out with whatever needs, you know, the state has. So I think the devil will be in the details of how they balance the state's checkbook.
Especially considering we have a surplus. And so they have some money to play with right now. I think it's pretty substantial. substantial amount of money,
Steve.
Yeah,
that's correct.
All right, let's take another call, gentlemen. Again, it's our monthly economic roundup today in the Exchange. We've been looking at some of the top economic headlines around the state. Right now, we're focusing on what Governor-elect Sununu might do in terms of economic policy. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Dave's in Hopkinton. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. You're in the air. Welcome.
Hi. I'm a newly elected member of the House of Representatives here in New Hampshire, and I'm going to be trying to focus on this thing to do with jobs for the people who obviously just haven't gotten a decent raise in a long time. And the challenge, getting back to what we were talking about earlier, is that when you look to businesses to fund education and training, they don't have the sense an employee is going to stay there for more than 3 or 4 years like they did 30 years ago. And so the challenge is going to be for the state to come up with tax incentives and other ways of encouraging businesses to push for those kinds of training that otherwise they might not have a financial incentive to do.
You know, that is a really interesting point, Dave. So the idea, Russ, that, you know, why invest in all that training that we talked about earlier with our other caller? Why invest, Steve, you want to jump in, when people change jobs so quickly these days?
That is part of Governor-elect Sununu's plan. He did say that he was going to include business tax credits for job training activities.
Okay. All right.
And sort of the new model that we talked about earlier today of kind of a partnership between employer, a very direct partnership between employers and the state's colleges, technical colleges particularly, what had been community colleges, also is responsive to that.
Well, I have to say this, you know, as a baby boomer, you know, the world has changed a lot, and companies used to train their employees because there was an agreement, unwritten, but an agreement where you could stay at a certain job for a long time, have a career, and you have a pension. That's not the way the world is anymore. So there's a different dynamic at work here with companies having the incentive to train employees, because employees don't have the same loyalty that they may have had 30, 40 years ago.
Okay, so it's interesting to hear his point, and then, Steve, hear from you that Governor-elect Sununu has talked about that. Here's a couple more questions from our listeners about what the incoming governor might do in terms of the economy. Michael says, is there any proof that the business tax cuts from the last legislative session had any effect on job creation? Gentlemen?
I've thought about it. It's probably
still too new, huh?
Yeah, it's kind of new. And also, I think that the dominant force structuring the state's economy continues to be the U.S. economy. So that if the tide is rising nationally, New Hampshire participates in that. And when the nation is going into a downturn, New Hampshire does as well. So I would say not yet.
We don't know yet.
Yeah, we kind of don't know. I have a feeling it's symbolically important in terms of if you could actually measure it, and you can't.
Well,
probably not as important.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Steve, it was just not even 6 months ago, right? It was June that these went into effect. It seems like a million, thousand, trillion years ago.
Right. But there's not enough time to really understand. The only people that really are certain that of the impact were those on either side of the debate. you know, but I will say this, that, you know, even if you take into consideration that we changed, and if you give it a year's worth of time to have an impact, North Carolina decreased their corporate taxes by 20%. We did virtually nothing. So it's hard for an economist to say that this small change had a material impact. It just happens to be at a time when we're seeing big increases in corporate tax receipts, which I think people are assuming means that the BPT changes had an impact.
Okay, yeah, so Michael, I guess the answer to your email is we'll see.
But to Russ's point, I mean, it also is. I think the hit for businesses in New Hampshire, as anywhere, the biggest hit is federal taxes, and it's not necessarily the amount of money they're paying to the BPT. You know,
yeah, the biggest hit to New Hampshire businesses is property tax.
Yeah, property taxes. That's a very good point. I stand corrected. Thank you.
Speaking of that, here's another email again on this topic of how a new governor, new leadership in Concord might affect taxes and the economy. This is Mark in Exeter who says, people in New Hampshire should consider that there is a lot more certainty in the local tax picture. He says, even though the media is paying a lot of attention to iterations of Trump's income tax reform, He says, with fiscal conservatives in the corner office and both chambers of the state house, the pledge by the majority party never to consider new sources of state revenue is in fact a pledge to raise local property taxes. The effects of such inevitable tax hikes for working families are nearly certainly more impactful for the average citizen than changes in U.S. income taxes. So he's saying, you know, forget about all this. What's Trump going to do with taxes? Focus on what may happen in New Hampshire. Steve?
Yeah, well, since the recession, we've had a number of changes which have, in effect, shifted financial responsibility for obligations that used to be the state down to local communities. So we, and I think we might be talking about this later, we stopped paying for any of the pension that the local governments are responsible for now. We eliminated for the time being or put into mothballs the school building aid assistance, and we have generally taken resources away from municipal governments, and that's translated into increases in property tax rates. Yeah.
So let's talk about the pensions just a little bit. Bloomberg News recently ranked New Hampshire among the worst funded pension systems. They had a sort of list of the top 10, top meaning not good, top meaning underfunded, and New Hampshire was, I think, 9 or 8. So just remind us, Jeff, if you could please, first of all, who this system covers.
Okay. I know it's full disclosure, it covers my wife. So
she's
a retired teacher. Yes.
Okay.
But the retirement system covers most public employees in the state.
That's NHRS, teachers. New Hampshire Retirement System.
New Hampshire Retirement System covers police officers, firefighters, teachers, pretty much any public employee for the most part gets some kind of a pension. And the state has in its made decisions in the 90s and to basically not fund it as much as it should have. It just kind of because returns on investments were so great. They said, well, we don't have to pay our share into it. So it ended up the state, because as we know, after the dot-com bust and then interest rates in the last few years have been so bad, returns have been so bad, the retirement system has been severely underfunded. And they came up with a mechanism, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, to have it with a target of, I think, 2030 something, to fully fund it again. So as towns just found out that they had to pay, they're paying a bigger chunk of their employees' retirement, towards retirement, to help meet that underfunded thing. Now, New Hampshire's about 60% underfunded, which makes it one of the worst in the country. But there is a silver lining in the cloud, and we are on a steady improvement because not too long ago it was 52% underfunded, and then it was 56. Now it's 60, so it's heading on the right trajectory.
You mean 60% funded?
Funded. I mean funded. Yeah. I'm sorry. I apologize. Using the wrong. It was underfunded by about. It's underfunded by about 40%, as opposed to states like Illinois and New Jersey, which are complete disasters and have even made attempts to do what New Hampshire's doing, which is basically saying we have a plan. We're going to work on fully funding this thing by 2036, I think is the date. And they are working in that direction. You know, employees pay more towards it. And right now, the really serious problem facing the retirement system is like anybody who has an investment. If you're a retired person living on your own investments, returns have been really bad. Low interest rates have really hurt these retirement systems all across the country.
So it's a lot of people, first of all, when you hear about New Hampshire retirement system, Steve, you think state employees, but it's also all those many, many, many local teachers, local firefighters, police, and so forth. But still, a subset of the Granite State population, how does this affect the rest of us? I mean, beyond saying, gee, that's too bad, they have to contribute more, gee, that's too bad, they might not get as much. Right. How does that affect, everybody at this table?
So to take what Jeff said and just sort of project forward what it looks like for a community, the rate of return that's required by the investment committee of the retirement system is 7.25%. That means it has to grow at 7.25%. The corpus of the fund has
like
to grow.
Lot.
Or you have to pay more as an individual, or local communities have to pay more.
In other words, taxpayers.
Right. So you'll note that in the last year, the New Hampshire retirement system identified an additional amount of resources that were going to be required of local communities. Yes. Nashua has said that they're going to have to make changes in the employment and to meet those obligations. If the stock market doesn't grow as it has historically done, then we will be in a constant state of looking to local communities and local and individuals who are in the retirement system to up the ante. The state has no skin in the game financially any longer.
Wow. So more pain for local taxpayers and local retirees.
if the stock market continues, as most people say, we're unlikely to return to the, you know, 90s period where we were seeing very high rate of return on the stock market.
To Steve's point earlier about the burden on the property taxpayer, it keeps on being pushed down. Things like this didn't necessarily, or necessarily as extreme when the state did chip in to help fund the retirement system.
And I think as we get into the budget season, I think one of the most important questions that the legislature will grapple with, particularly the House, is it time to take some portion of that surplus and give it back to local
communities?
There
used to be something called revenue sharing.
Right.
Well, I guess no more. Well, and speaking of what the House and Senate will do and Governor Lex Sununu will do, I'm guessing we'll be talking about that on the Econ Roundup next year. But how about over the next month, guys? What are you going to be looking at, Russ?
I think interest rates right now are kind of the volatile part of the economy and are reflecting sentiment over the new election and, among other things, the economy generally.
And political uncertainty in Europe.
Right. The probability of the Fed raising rates by some measures has gone up to 95% by raising rates in December next month. So I'm looking at interest rates. I think they're very, from day to day, they say a lot about what's going on.
Yeah, although, boy, it seems like every month people say, they're going to raise it, they're going to raise it.
I know.
And then they don't.
And they've been saying that for 2 years themselves. Right. So they've lost some credibility over this, and that may even push them to raise rates.
Real quick, Jeff, what are you going to look at?
Actually, at the Business Review, we're looking at everything this over the next month because we do our annual preview at the end of December of our last issue of the year. And so we'll be looking at everything that's affecting New Hampshire economically. Talk to a bunch of business people, economists like Russ, and we'll see what's happening.
Wonderful. Maybe we'll work off of that next time around. Steve, what are you going to be looking at in the next couple weeks?
I'm going to be paying attention to how the Trump economics and Sununu economics actually are articulated. They're both governor-elect and president-elect are going to have to put some meat around their proposals coming forward, and that's going to impact interest rates much more than the stock market or Yellen at this point as she makes decisions about, what to do with the interest rate.
All right, great. We will talk again in about a month. Thank you all so much. This is The Exchange on NHPR.